Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark LaLiberty, and joining me today is...
Cabin Fever Corey Knockreiner.
I'm 90% sure that's been your name for the last 3 weeks. Actually kind of makes
that's
sense.
That's all I'm feeling right now. I have Wilsons everywhere. I talked to my 3D prints. Hi, Baby Yoda, how are you today? Really? Nice to meet you.
On today's episode, we cover the latest in the news, including a NSA alert on the Sandworm nation-state-backed hacking organization, a few alerts from Google's threat analysis group, some COVID-related phishing, and a deprecation of a relatively old hashing algorithm. With that, let's go ahead and hop right in. So first up on the docket today is an alert from the NSA, which, you know, it's actually kind of rare that they issue these alerts. It seems like it's been happening a little more recently. But just this last week, the NSA put out an alert stating that Russian cyber actors from the GRU, Main Center for Special Technologies, or GTSST, field post number 74455, have been actively exploiting a vulnerability in the XM mail transfer agent software since August 2019. Corey laughs, I assume, because that was super specific.
That's an NSA flex. That's we know the exact field post they're at.
For those that don't have experience with setting up mail servers, XM is one of, if not the most popular server software. It's responsible for about half of the world's email servers. It acts as the mail transfer agent, which is the basically what we call a mail server in a simple form. But back in June of 2019, researchers disclosed CVE-2019-10149, which is also known as Return of the Wizard, which enables remote code execution on unpatched XM servers by sending a command in the mail from SMTP message. This is
kind of a big deal, old school flaw in that a popularly exposed network service, I think it's relatively easily exploitable, right? So it's one of those flaws that you have the mail server there and bam, you got easy remote route.
Yeah, it's basically because mail servers by nature basically have to be exposed to the internet and accepting mail. This vulnerability was pretty big news at the time because you basically can send commands to go download shell scripts and execute them because of how it parses the mail from message and the SMTP handshake or whatever you want to call it. In fact, 2 weeks after this vulnerability was disclosed, Microsoft actually issued an alert warning that threat actors were creating a XM self-spreading worm that was exploiting its way through servers running on the Azure infrastructure as well. As of May 2020, so this month though, or I guess technically last month by the time that people listen to this, only half of all XM servers have been patched for this flaw, which is kind of amazing.
That blows me away. That's crazy for this level of flaw. I mean, when you, like I say, old school flaw, when you have a popular production, have to, as you said, like an email web server, those things you have to expose. So not to patch those flaws quickly is crazy. I guess it does have to do with the fact that production servers, people are sometimes scared to update, but you gotta worry about it for this sort of level of service.
And you have to wonder, like, how many of these exposed servers or unpatched servers that are exposed to the internet have already been exploited, because it is pretty trivial to exploit this vulnerability, and it gives you code execution on the server. You can do whatever the heck you want within the privilege level that the mail transfer agent's running at, which in many cases, or possibly most cases, would be root level access. Yeah. I wonder how many like zombie servers we have running around. I could not believe that half of all XM servers are unpatched and none of them are exploited or currently pwned.
Yeah, that's why this is crazy. I mean, this is, when I say old school vulnerability, this level of severity doesn't happen often. So like you, I would be surprised if those servers aren't already popped.
Exactly. So the NSA's alert was basically designed to both alert administrators to update their servers, and also to name and shame Russia's cyber espionage efforts. Like I mentioned, they've been doing this a little more often, it seems like. Both them and the FBI and other intelligence agencies within the states have been starting to call out nation states over their cyber espionage practices.
Yeah, it seems like in this sort of international thing where you can't really attack back has a lot of political ramifications. You know, I think this kind of shaming thing is one of the few things they can do, and at least shows the adversary that we're watching and we know.
That was, like you said, a pretty big flex of pointing out the specific field post where they think the attacks came from. Yeah. In their advisory that they put out, they actually had some pretty decent defensive tips too. The first one is what should be most obvious one, just patch your dang servers. If you patch the vulnerability does not exist. But then they also talked about using like intrusion prevention technologies to block the exploit. They gave like a Yara rule in order to detect it, since it's been around for a while. It's pretty easy to detect this type of exploit. They also recommended a defense in depth strategy. So making sure you have layers of security, something that you and I and every other security professional in the world preaches almost every single day. And then also they said, don't only expose the necessary ports, but also restrict outbound traffic to just the necessary ports. So the ports required for mail transfer, like IMAP, SMTP, POP3, if you're still using that, maybe ActiveSync, so 443. Because, for example, like if the adversaries are able to infect your server, if you block whatever outbound command and control connection it has back to the command and control server, even though it's technically infected, they might not be able to actually do anything to that server. So restricting outbound traffic is equally as important as restricting inbound traffic to these types of servers.
Yeah, that's why we always at WatchGuard here push egress filtering. That's a trick you can do with almost anything. Helps with not all, but a lot of botnets too.
Exactly.
As an aside, by the way, you mentioned the like NSA's tips were good ones. Those generic tips are probably the same as what we would give regardless of their alert. But for WatchGuard customers out there, do know our IPS service does specifically have a signature for this. Let's see, what is the number? It looks like it's number 1135742 if you guys want to look it up.
You have that memorized,
right?
We do
have a signature for this. Yeah, it just came off the top of my head. I have all like 120,000, you know, ready to go. Don't test me though. We're too busy with the podcast to do that test right now.
Exactly. But later we'll do that test.
Yeah, later. Offline when we're not recording.
If you are a WatchGuard customer and you do maintain your own mail server, please make sure it's patched. But otherwise, just make sure you're using security services and good best practices for securing your servers, and you have a decent chance of being protected against this. That said, like, it's Russia. Who knows who they're going to go after next? It seemed like, based off the alert, this was targeted after not like, you know, what you would think is government organizations, but it sounded like legitimate just espionage going after private industries as well. Which is something we've seen from other state or nation states as well. Like North Korea has been trying to steal money from cryptocurrency exchanges. China has been accused of espionage, even lately with COVID-related incidents. I mean, even Vietnam was accused of hacking
into
China.
We also have an election coming up too, so the nation state we're speaking of could certainly look for intelligence around that too. Well, owning an email server at business may not be directly related. There could be something they're getting ready for that as well.
But you're implying that they would ever want to possibly hack a mail server. I don't think we've ever seen that happen before.
Yeah, not a government email server either, where they steal a lot of political people's information.
No.
That's never happened.
That will
never
ever happen. So moving on, also last week, Google's Threat Analysis Group, or TAG for short, published some info on a few threats that they've been tracking over the last month. So they started by reiterating information that they shared on COVID-themed attacks targeting medical and healthcare professionals, as well as World Health Organization employees. But they also gave some more details on some hacker-for-hire firms that were based out of India that have been creating Gmail accounts, spoofing World Health Organization individuals, and using that to target organizations across multiple countries. They gave some details. They said that the phishes were disguised as newsletters with sign-up forms, And they typically feature fake login forms designed to phish Google account credentials and personal information like phone numbers from the recipients. We've talked about hacker for hire or malware as a service stuff kind of frequently, or at least a few times on this podcast. But maybe that deserves a bit of an explanation, Corey.
Hacker for hire?
Yeah.
Well, everything's as a service nowadays. I mean, if you go on the underground, you can rent a botnet as a service. You can find a forum where you can have a hacker do, you know, point, you know, specific projects for you. They have a very rich underground.
Yeah, we've even seen like malware or ransomware where they host basically the entire infrastructure, including payment accepting and developing the malware, and they just leave you in charge of distributing it. We've even seen examples where these malware authors have their own tech support department for their quote-unquote customers, so that if you're having trouble troubleshooting your malware or something, or your payment infrastructure, you can call up tech support and get some help with it. Like, there are full-on industries for hackers for hire or malware as a service on the dark web and even the not-so-dark web.
Yeah, to your services point, I mean, sometimes you can buy an exploit kit, but then you also annually pay for a service, which includes, as you point out, not just the tech support for the exploit kit, but maybe new batches of vulnerabilities every so often. So pretty rich, if nefarious, economy. And I would say India is a hotspot, probably economically related. You know, you have an area where you have highly educated folks with less opportunities. I actually don't think that's an excuse for crime, but you could imagine why certain world geographies might have more than average hacker for hire services. They even have like a crowdsourced CAPTCHA stuff. I mean, I know it's less hacking, but you know, while we have a lot of automated technology to break CAPTCHAs, there are newer CAPTCHAs that can't really be broken. So in India, you could literally buy humans filling out CAPTCHAs for you all day.
My favorite CAPTCHA, if we're going to go down this tangent, the new one I've been seeing cropping up, like on I think it was the Epic Game Stores where I saw it first, but a few other places now, is the one where you have to spin the little picture of the animal until it's facing right the way up and then hit done. Yeah. And it gives you like a, hooray, you did it in 2.3 seconds. Good job.
At least that's an easy one. The one issue with this darn CAPTCHA hacking automated technology is they're getting harder and harder for the humans, too. There's one or two CAPTCHAs where even I have to do it twice before I get it right, because there's like images that are slight gray area. Well, it could be interpreted as that. So it's getting that they have to make CAPTCHAs so hard for humans that even the human entry is a pain in the butt. I much prefer your little twisting 3D objects to the right, side.
Yeah,
that's easy.
That one's at least fun, and it feels like it's gamification. I know we did a whole episode, or at least like a section on CAPTCHA earlier last year, I believe, and how they design it where they take, it's not just like you correctly picking which image is a bus and then hitting verify. It's like tracking your mouse movement as you go to see if it's something that's more natural like a human would do, or if it's automated like a computer would do, at the time it takes to click on everything.
Peeking at a lot of headers and technical indicators from the traffic you send as you do this.
Yep. Same reason why, like, sometime or more often than not, if you go to a CAPTCHA, you just click the I'm not a robot button and you're good to go.
Yep.
But for like me, if I'm like going through the Tor browser or something to a site, sometimes you have to go
and
find
VPN.
30 million buses before you're allowed to verify that you're a human.
The sadness of having a constant private VPN for security.
Exactly. So
cool. Back to Google.
Back to Google. As a part of this blog post, though, they also talked about a new quarterly bulletin that their team is going to be putting out, where they're basically going to try and be more transparent and share information on coordinated state-sponsored groups that have been targeting Google users and then the actions that Google's taken to stop them. For example, they just published their quarter one bulletin where they highlighted over the course of January, February, March, a couple hundred instances where they had to take down YouTube channels or AdSense accounts or terminate Gmail accounts that were because they were being used as coordinated influence operations. They gave some examples of like Iran and Egypt and India, among a few others.
Weren't there like thousands of Chinese YouTube accounts too?
kind of interesting stuff.
By the way, this nation state stuff, it'd be good threat intelligence for us to share with our audience, but it's also, we'll get lots of fun names to make fun of. I think the COVID-19 nation state actors that are doing some of the World Health Organization scams are called Charming Kitten. So just wanted to leave that there.
Charming Kitten.
Charming Kitten is trying to scam you.
Why do we get, like,
I think that's true of all kittens. They're always trying to scam us for food, those Charming Kittens.
I do like how they get that name, and then, like, that the Russian outfit we talked about just a little bit ago, their official, or quote-unquote official name, code name is Sandworm by NSA, which is at least kind of cool.
I don't know. Sandworm sounds gross.
Yeah, I mean, you've read Dune, right?
I guess,
right?
I think of Sandworm Dune, sounds terrifying, so maybe that's cool. Yeah. Maybe if you're writing it, it's kind of cool.
I guess it's better than Fancy Bear or Cozy Bear or the other Russian state actor group names we get. I'm going to make a tool, I've decided. I'm going to make a website where you can go in and it'll automatically generate a new name for either your vulnerability or your nation state hacking group.
And I think that would be fun. We can come up with a thesaurus list of adjectives, adverbs, whatever. Adjectives, probably.
Yep. Adjective noun for the state actor group, and then random gibberish for the or crappy pun for the vulnerability.
Yeah, there we go. Done. Ship it.
So the point of this Google post, though, is they're trying to be more transparent on these attacks targeting Google customers and Google employees. You can actually read, they've got some pretty decent research that they posted before. It's blog.google /threat-analysis-group is where it's hosted. Actually, another quick tangent. We need a .watchguard top-level domain so we can have blog.watchguard, because that's actually kind of neat, and I'm a little jealous.
Yeah, we ought to do that. Top-level domains have been, or new custom top-level domains have been available for a while now. I think they're really expensive, though, to actually get a .watchguard to yourself or a .tv or whatever.
That's a good point. I know, actually, I listened to like a Planet Money podcast episode at some point where they followed someone who was trying to register like .wedding or .wedd, and they basically went through the process of how you apply for it and you pay the $10,000 and hopefully get approved. It was kind of fascinating. I'll have to find that and like link it in the show notes, because it was a good episode.
The practical takeaways is you definitely should read Google's threat research, but I guess we should talk a little bit more about what you should do about COVID-19 scam emails. But maybe before we do that, we should probably talk about the next story too.
Great segue, Corey. So researchers at Abnormal Security published some findings on a COVID-related phish they found last week that they said targeted between 15,000 and 50,000 mailboxes. So in their example, the phish arrives from an email address support@who.international with the World Health Organization as the from name. And it states that the WHO wants to send you a message, and it contains a link to open the message. But when you click on that link, the page is hosted on some random unrelated domain. It prompts you to enter your email, username, and password, followed by a phone number, and then redirects you to the main World Health Organization website. And this, like, they showed screenshots in their article they published on it. To any trained professional, not even just like tech or security professional, anyone that's been trained to spot a fish, this is quite obviously a fish. But like we've talked about this a few times too, how crises like this current pandemic lower the tipping point that it takes to get an untrained user to click on a fish. And so even though it seems obvious to us in this case, like there's a lot of people that probably fall for this style of attack.
Absolutely.
So we've actually seen a few examples too through our own DNS watch service, where we get to see and block connections to phishing domains. And we even have the option for some customers to report phishes to us. We've seen ones recently that try to direct users to a scam site for buying testing kits. So the email is basically saying, oh, you can buy these quick 10-minute tests. Come here to check it out. Unfortunately for that one, or I guess fortunately, but unfortunately from a research standpoint, the scam itself was pretty dang boring. Like the phone number on the site connected to just a well-known scam number, the domain it was hosted on, or I think it was the server it was hosted on, so the IP address had been previously associated with 140-something phishing scams in the last 30 days. So that one was kind of boring, but we did see a more interesting one right after that, where it appeared to come from...
Yeah, that's the one that came from UN, right, to small business owners, but this is the one that's actually a classic phish and that it is trying to get you to sign in to something and steal your credentials. Is that right?
So that first one I was talking about was a kind of boring just scam one. The second one was one we just saw pop in last week, I think, to a few users, where it claimed to come from the United Nations offering small business owners assistance with loans. But if they click through the links...
That's what I just said.
Yeah, prompted them to log in for that one as well. So there's been a lot of COVID-related phishing recently. Most of them seem geared towards stealing email credentials right now, which I guess is what attackers go after the most, because if you can get into someone's email account, you basically can get into any account they have associated with that, as long as they're not protected with multi-factor.
And there's a good chance that the password used there, besides the email, being the account reset place. So Mark's point is you can get into other accounts by using a account reset mechanism to that email address. But even if it's just a corporate network, there's a decent chance that the password on the email account is one they use other places too. So you may not even need a reset mechanism to crack into other locations.
You seem to be implying that people don't pick strong, unique passwords for each of their individual accounts.
Unfortunately, the other side effect to all the data breaches we see every single week is we keep on seeing the same passwords every single week, so it seems unlikely they're listening to the obvious advice. Other than our listeners know better. They're probably as exasperated by this as we are.
And if for some reason you haven't already started using a password manager, they are really great tools. And I know that some organizations are still hesitant to allow their users to use password managers, but they are genuinely a good tool and can improve your security simply by enabling them not to reuse the same password over and over. That paired with multi-factor can really help you out.
Well, while we're saying how good tools they are, you know, we think they're good tools for security reasons, but honestly, they make your life easy. You know, how many times have you had to log in every day when you're going to 12 different sites? I mean, the autofill thing alone almost acts as a single sign-on. So don't only use them for security, but they just make a life a lot easier when you have logins pushed in your face all the time.
Yep. And still...
So...
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
You first, sir.
No, I was actually going to pivot to tips for this type of scam, but so why don't we finish your thought on that subject?
Well, sir, I was going to pivot to tips on this scam, so let's go ahead and get started. Okay.
Well, I guess we could give our normal tips, but I just saw a post at scamspotter.org, which is basically a site that helps you find these sort of email scams and what to do. And they kind of up-leveled the tips for normal consumers even more for specifically COVID-19 pandemic stuff. So we'll give our normal email phishing tips in a second, but their basic three high-level golden rules for COVID-19 related skepticism is the one is slow down and trust doctors over peddlers. Right? And this is, if it's about a pandemic, anyone that's trying to sell you something, any thermometer emails or come here to, you know, peddlers are immediately someone you should not trust. They have money motivation, and they could be very likely fishers with money motivation. So pay less attention to emails from that and more to doctors. The next thing is to spot check, and I guess this does fall into our tips, which is consult government sources. You know, if you're getting email about COVID specifically, about either maybe unemployment or about the disease itself, you want to go directly to sites like the IRS for unemployment and tax stuff, and CDC or WHO for you know, government pandemic related information. So if you're getting any emails that are saying they're those entities, look at the links. Maybe never go to the links directly through the email and visit the site directly. And then their final tip is stop and don't send, which is basically don't pay for government benefits. If you're getting all these emails about stimulus checks and unemployment payments and Medicare, but then whatever you do requires a small fee before you do it, it's bullcrap. You don't have to pay for these government benefits. That's why they're benefits. So any email that's directing you to, even if it's a small payment for sending something, it's probably crap. So I really like those three tips, mostly because they were less technical, so they really translate to any user on the internet.
Yeah,
and they beyond that, Mark, any other thoughts?
Yeah, I was going to say they translate even to outside COVID-related phishing too. Like, just don't click on links and emails. Go to the site manually. Don't submit payments based off requests you get from emails before picking up the phone and calling to verify as well. Like, a lot of those tips could go a pretty far way to keeping you safe from falling victim to one of these phishes, even un-COVID related.
Absolutely. It's all about a little bit of skepticism. Trust but validate.
Exactly. And in a time where we're all doing a lot less face-to-face communication, unless you're hopping on Zoom meetings, that is, and relying a lot more on emails, like that additional picking up the phone call or hitting a video chat on Teams or Zoom or whatever can do a lot to keep you from falling victim to one of these. So finally up on the docket is some news from OpenSSH. So OpenSSH is the most widely used utility for command line access to remote servers. Anyone that manages a Linux server or a NIC server or has ever connected to an IoT device to see what's running on the inside is pretty familiar with SSH and probably OpenSSH. Well, they just announced their plans last week that they are finally deprecating SHA-1 as an authentication method, citing concerns with the SHA-1 hashing algorithm's security. So SHA-1 as a hashing algorithm, maybe we should take a step back and talk about what a hashing algorithm does real quick. It's basically a one-way math function where you can take data, so computer data, a picture, a file, something, and stick it through this algorithm, and it puts out a predefined length bit of basically not random, but looks randomized text. And anytime you put the exact same data through the algorithm, you get the exact same hash of that file or data.
Ultimately, it's a unique identifier of a specific set of data. And the one thing, by the way, just for the nerds out there, when you're creating good hash algorithms, one of the biggest worries is collisions. For it to be a unique indicator of a specific set of data, you never want two different set of data that end up with the same hash, the same set of random looking numbers or letters. The problem is, one point you mentioned, Mark, is usually these are set to be a specific length. You know, even if you're using a tiny bit of data or a huge amount of data, the MD5 or SHA-1 hash will always be the same size. And if you just apply pure logic, you realize that, say, you only have 256 characters to represent something. Any data over 256 characters, you know, immediately you're never going to have enough, even though 256, the variations of that are in the huge numbers, you still can have more variations of data than you can have unique hashes. So I would say today all hashes eventually will have collisions because we're using a small representation to uniquely identify big data sets. But for a good hash algorithm, it should be able to represent a huge amount of data sets, but always be able to give it a unique, you know, a unique attribute or unique indicator, that hash itself, that never matches any other data. Yep. Although the never is unrealistic with the size of hashes today.
So SHA-1 actually had theoretical attacks against it back in 2005. It was deprecated by NIST in 2011. It was actually broken in practice in 2017 by some Google researchers, who disclosed the shattered vulnerability in it, which basically allowed them to create two PDF files that collided. They had the exact same hash, even though they were technically different on the inside. But back in 2017, that attack was computationally very expensive, and it required a certain set of parameters to make it actually work.
And by the way, that is the collision we were just talking about. So when you hear of a hash collision, two PDF files that can have the same hash is exactly that, a collision.
Exactly. As part of their like proof of concept, though, they were talking about how you might have two different PDF files that are like a contract for something. And if you can have a generate a collision, you can have the contract that was actually signed and verified by a hash say one thing, and then some maybe maliciously modified contract that has the same hash that might be upheld in whatever court or whatever you're trying to do.
Hey, Mark, can you please sign this PDF that tells me you owe me $5? Well, thank you, Mark. Let me change that to $500 million.
Exactly. Oh,
look at that. It's cryptographically signed, bank. You need to take Mark to jail.
Take Mark to jail. Please don't.
Because I have a feeling he can't pay back that $500 million.
Yeah, that sounds like a bad deal.
Yeah, it is.
The cost of generating a collision for SHA-1 has come down even in just the last 3 years. The last update was earlier this year. The classic shattered style attack is estimated to be only around $50,000 worth of cloud computing power, which is well inside the realm of both nation states and even just big hacking organizations, I'd say.
I'm glad you meant the cloud computing power. It might be obvious to technical folks, but when we say the cost to get a collision, it really comes down to lots and lots of CPU, GPU cycles, lots and lots of maths that heavy distributed computings do. So the cost, as you pointed out, was in cloud compute resource.
Yep, for the lots of maths.
Yep. By the way, we jokingly call it maths here in the U.S. as a joke, pretending like we're ignorant of the maths. But in the U.K., maths is actually grammatically correct because there are multiple maths.
This is America.
Calculus, trigonometry. That's true. This is Merca, where we don't understand the maths.
We only got them one math. Long story short. OpenSSH, or at least the maintainers of it, are now disabling the SSH SHA public key signature algorithm, which generates SSH-based authentication keys. You might have used this before if you've authenticated using a public-private key pair as opposed to entering a password when you log into something over SSH. The good news is, for quite a while now, a SHA-256-based key has been the default when generating new keys for OpenSSH. But like as some people have pointed out, there's a lot of legacy like embedded systems and IoT devices that are probably running older versions of OpenSSH and are probably using SHA-1 based keys. And there's a decent chance that they can't be updated because, as we know, IoT and embedded systems are often rather difficult to maintain security patches on. So this could actually cause a few issues if you start updating your clients to have whatever the latest security patches are, which also happen to disable this particular authentication algorithm. But
yeah, and if you kind of follow the pattern of MD5, MD5 was deprecated long, long ago. I don't have the dates on hand, but we both know it's been dead for a while. Many companies still use MD5. It's taken, I feel like, a decade for people to really move to SHA-1 to some extent. I mean, I'm sure security companies and anyone that's actually using the hash for some sort of security related purpose will move quicker. But with how long MD5s were and still are being leveraged, I have a feeling it's going to take the industry a long time to move off of SHA-1 entirely.
Yep.
The good news is, and I think it's worth exploring a little, that not everything has to have, I mean, hashes are used for multiple purposes, and some need to be really secure because you're literally using the hash as some sort of security checksum, right? The whole point of the hash is to do some security control, in which case you want that hash to be as secure and accurate as possible. But there's a lot of cases where programs use hashing for very simple things where, yeah, it should be accurate, but it's not the end of the world, you know. It's not necessarily a vulnerability just because, you know, there may be no reason for someone to do a collision. They may not give them any sort of access. So whether or not every device has to go to SHA-1, it really depends on what the hash is being used for.
So in the case of this, with it being used as authentication to the server itself, it makes sense to deprecate it and get it out of there as quickly
Absolutely.
As possible. But for example,
OpenSSH.
Like, if I'm just taking a SHA-1 hash of a file to then go query VirusTotal to see if it's seen that particular malware payload or not, I could probably continue using SHA-1 for quite some... In fact, crap, I still use MD5.
MD5. Yeah. Although, you're just querying informationally, and I absolutely agree with you, but if you were to, say, make an endpoint security product, that one of the ways it decides if something is good or bad is that hash check, then you don't want it to have a collision, because then someone might, like, if you're using hashes for whitelisting to whitelist good files that you don't want to block because maybe they're part of the operating system, then a collision could result in someone making a bad file look good to your whitelist. So it really all depends on how the programmer's using the hash. But in either case, like you said, for OpenSSH, it's absolutely a must that they get off bad hashes.
Yep. And I will say, like...
Bad algorithms, I should say.
Bad algorithms. In general, like, the industry, the security industry, does a pretty good job of deprecating and getting off of these algorithms and cipher suites before they are actually fundamentally broken. Like, obviously, yep. WEP is an example of a time where they didn't quite do it as quickly as they should have. I'd say SHA-1 is kind of cutting it close if the cost of a collision is down to $50,000 now. But there's some other examples, like TLS 1.1, for example, which a lot of web browsers and certificate authorities are starting to deprecate now. It isn't technically fundamentally broken. Like, it supports some weak cipher suites, and it can support some weak algorithms, but in general, it's not like fundamentally broken like TLS 1.0 and SSL v3 were, where there were attacks against the protocol standard itself that broke encryption.
Yep. Yeah, so the takeaway there is actually good on those browser companies for moving to TLS 1.2 and 1.3. We like it when security companies or companies are security considerate. That said, your own push to go to, you know, you should not consider TLS 1.1 is considered weakened, and as you said, some bad cipher suites by cryptographers, but it still hasn't been proven that you can really break it at a low cost for say simple web encrypted traffic using TLS 1.1. Unless you're, I guess, using specifically the bad cipher. So you got to be careful with the cryptographer and security expert's view of these ciphers and algorithms. You know, sometimes researchers will find weaknesses that, you know, rather than taking, you know, 200,000 years to crack something, it suddenly takes 50,000 years. And mathematically, that's a pretty significant weakening. But from a pure practical standpoint, it still would take an attacker 50,000 years right. to crack it. So kind of separate yourself from the research sometimes, even if you're nerdy like us, and follow it. TLS 1.1, definitely good to opportunistically get off as soon as you can, but I don't think it's the end of the world if you're still using it today.
And the good news is, like, the client side and TLS SSL connections is the one that chooses what protocol to use. So unless there's someone actively man-in-the-middling your connection and forcing a downgrade, you just basically get a pick. Your browser will automatically pick whatever the most secure one is. And not many clients actually use TLS 1.1. It's something like 1/3 of 1% of all internet traffic
at
Cloudflare last year used TLS 1.1, mostly because it was pretty short-lived before TLS 1.2 came out, so...
But what I imagine they care about is the downgrade attack. It's, I mean, to your point, that requires a man in the middle. But the whole point, like TLS 1.1 itself is not fundamentally broken, but the reason, if one of its ciphers happens to be weak, you know, in a downgrade attack, I can trick the server into thinking your client is asking for that specific cipher, and that's the one you want to agree on. So that's why people do worry about it. But to Mark's point, it's still not the, you know, that still requires a man-in-the-middle attack. So unless you're on untrusted Wi-Fi or whatever, the chances of someone getting man-in-the-middle just randomly over the internet with you is pretty small. They'd have to get malware onto your network or somehow pop your gateway or something.
Yep. So if you're just a random IT guy or someone listening to this podcast, your takeaway should be just keep your systems up to date. And vendors will take care of disabling insecure protocols for you. And if you're on a insecure network, like public Wi-Fi, use something like a VPN. preferably one that does enforce minimum security levels like TLS 1.2 by default. For example, RSSL VPN client only does as well. That can help protect you against a really sophisticated man-in-the-middle attack that tries to downgrade your connection. Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future episode topics, you can reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at XORRO, Corey's at SecAdept, and the both of us are at hashtag the443podcast. Thanks again for listening, and you will hear from us next week.